Normally, we end our Monday program with a commentary from Michelle Martin. Today, we hear from another member of the Tell Me More team. Our senior producer, Alicia Montgomery, offers her thoughts on why the media seems so unwilling to take scandalous golfing star Tiger Woods' recent public apology at face value.
From the moment Tiger Woods opened his mouth on Friday to say sorry to his family, his fans, and anyone else within the sound of his voice, much of the media was gleefully second-guessing him. From the blogosphere to cable news to Tell Me More's weekly barbershop roundtable, journalists were peppering him with put-downs and a series of queries we all know Tiger will never answer. Where was his wife? Why was he still so stilted in his speech, so wooden in his demeanor? And what was up with the hand-picked audience members and the refusal to take questions? The emerging conventional wisdom is that Woods should have stayed home if he wasn't ready to let it all hang out, lay his private actions and pain bare for the media and the American public. But if we in the media are going to demand honesty from him, we must be willing to demand it of ourselves and admit there was almost nothing Woods could have said or done, short of falling to his knees and begging for forgiveness, that would have satisfied us. Can I just tell you, I'm not a Tiger apologist. He should be condemned for deceiving his wife, his sponsors, and yes, the millions of fans who admired him not just for his athletic feats, but for the squeaky clean life he pretended to be living. I think that the "everybody makes mistakes" standard, where public figures get to wall off a huge range of their private behavior from scrutiny, has led to a dumbing down of our nation's ethical life, where we grant a blanket pass to those who pursue a life of calculated deceit. That being said, I've started to ask myself a very hard question. How much of the ongoing Tiger takedown is just a journalist's revenge fantasy? If there are two things that we in the media can't stand, one is being frozen out, and the other is being lied to or manipulated. And the public figures who get beat up the most are those who we believe have done both. Tiger Woods' years of success came in spite of his rejection of almost all interview invitations that were presented to him. And the fact that every third commercial seemed to feature a grinning Woods selling everything from sports drinks to luxury cars must have plucked the nerves of the reporters who covered him. Woods built his brand, successful, healthy, attractive, and wholesome, without talking to those of us who believe we should tell the American public who is worthy of their admiration and their contempt. So I wonder if Woods is now being punished less for disgracing his family and more for defying media expectations, even at the moment of his downfall. Many journalists passionately believe that it's our duty to uncover every piece of information our audience must know or even wants to know. But if we want the American public to trust our work, then they have to be able to trust our motives. And that means we, ourselves, need to know the difference between proper coverage and payback.
That was Tell Me More senior producer Alicia Montgomery. To respond to this commentary or anything you hear on our program, please check out our website. Go to npr.org, select Tell Me More from the program page, and blog it out. And that's our program for today. I'm Lynn Neary, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Everyone has one, something you find particularly annoying in the way some people talk, whether it's a mispronunciation, a grammatical mistake, a pretentious bit of jargon, or a tired cliche. When it comes to language, says our linguist Jeff Nunberg, we all have our pet peeves.
My friend Scott is always sending me indignant emails with examples of people using the word equation to mean just a situation with a lot of factors, where nothing's actually being equated, as in, family members are a critical part of the doctor-patient equation. I tell him I think of this as just routine journalistic bloat, and not even he thinks it's a threat to the Republic. But he enjoys grousing about it all the more because it doesn't seem to annoy anybody else that much. It makes for a fine pet peeve. Of course, I have peeves of my own. When I hear people say oversimplistic, I suspect they don't know that simplistic means that all by itself. I'd be happy if somebody would drive arguably and quite possibly into the sea. And it seems to me it's almost always a bad idea to begin a sentence with, I pride myself on. A pet peeve should be like a pet theory or a pet story, a tick or fancy that you nurture in your bosom and make your own. You can have a pet peeve about people who mispronounce mascarpone. But it's odd to use the phrase for off-the-rack gripes that everybody shares. Saying that you have a pet peeve about thinking outside the box or your call is important to us is like saying you have a pet theory that you should feed a cold and starve a fever. I have this notion that gingerly shouldn't be used as an adverb, as in she hugged the child gingerly, because there's no corresponding adjective ginger. You wouldn't say she gave the child a ginger hug. I'll concede that gingerly has been used as an adverb for 400 years, and nobody's ever complained about it before. But so much the better. Every time I see the word used as an adverb, I can take a quiet satisfaction in knowing that I'm marching to a more logical drummer than the 500 million other speakers of English who haven't yet cottoned to the problem. Writers tend to have lots of these notions. Kingsley Amis held that it was incorrect to use pristine to mean pure rather than original, and that you shouldn't say, I was oblivious to the noise, since oblivious can only mean forgetful. And in a usage book he published a few years ago, Bill Bryson contended that it was wrong to use expectorate as a synonym for spit, since it really means to cough up phlegm from the chest. The word did originally mean that, but it's been used to mean spit since Dickens's day. And Bryson knows perfectly well that it would be completely unreasonable to insist on the original meaning. Think of the mischief it would work with Major League Baseball's Rule 8.02, which says that the pitcher shall not expectorate on the ball. But Bryson also understands that it's the very unreasonableness of the argument that makes it so handy to have around when the dinner conversation flags. Nobody ever took this quite so far as the 19th century writer and journalist Ambrose Bierce. He's best remembered today for his stories and his satirical Devil's Dictionary. But in 1909, he wrote a book called Write It Right, A Little Blacklist of Literary Faults. It was republished for its centenary last year with entertaining annotations by Jan Freeman, who writes the language column for the Boston Globe. Bierce had a gift for discerning usage errors where no one else would have thought there was anything amiss. Take the sentence, since I made no money last year, I had to live in a dilapidated shack with a dirt floor with 10 other people. By Bierce's lights, that sentence contains 5 errors. You should say earn money, not make money. Last year should be the previous year. Dilapidated shouldn't be used for a wood structure, since it comes from the Latin word for stone. Dirt shouldn't be used to mean earth. And you shouldn't use people with a specific number. It should be 10 other persons. That makes Bierce sound like a caricature of a humorless pedant. But he clearly enjoyed being perverse and ornery. And my guess is that his journalist colleagues wouldn't have taken any of this too seriously. Oh, that's just Ambrose being Ambrose. The weird thing is to see rules like these passed down as traditional linguistic wisdom. Take that edict that you ought to say 10 persons rather than 10 people. You can still find it in the recent editions of Strunk and White's revered Elements of Style, along with antique admonitions against saying contact us or calling something worthwhile. The linguist Arnold Zwicky calls these zombie rules. Somebody should have run them through a wood chipper long ago, but here we are in 2010 assigning students a style guide that tells them that correct English requires them to write there were 5,000 screaming persons at the Lady Gaga concert. It's bad enough that that leaves students with the impression that mastering good usage requires them to learn an esoteric code. But it also robs those rules of the kinky charm they had when they were merely somebody's quizzical peeves. Now those personal crotchets are being offered as authorized standards, as if you could decree the tune the language is obliged to dance to. But the English language doesn't owe anybody a living. It was here first.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley.
On Monday night, Jay Leno makes his big move back to his old job, hosting The Tonight Show. As many people will remember, last year NBC moved Leno up to primetime. His new show did poorly in the ratings, and so now he's going back. And Conan O'Brien, who had taken over as The Tonight Show host, quit NBC altogether. The whole thing has been a public relations disaster for NBC and possibly for Leno. NPR's Elizabeth Blair takes a look at how the fiasco might affect his brand.
Watching Jay Leno is like eating stale Funyuns, says Simon Domenko of Ad Age.
His brand of humor just feels extremely dated.
It was so cold, Sarah Palin had to cancel a speech because she didn't want to take her gloves off to read.
Stale Funyuns might be okay really late at night, says Domenko, but not for dinner. And that's what happened when NBC moved Leno to prime time.
Stuff that kind of worked at 11:35 just didn't seem as funny when you're still wide awake at 10 o'clock.
And a lot of those wide awake viewers voted with their remotes by turning the channel. Domenko says TV comedy and the nature of wit has changed. Think the irony of Jon Stewart or the cynicism of Bill Maher. And he says Leno hasn't kept up. But John Murray, who writes about entertainment for AOL Black Voices, sees it differently. He says Jay Leno's brand of humor might not be hip, but it is more mainstream.
You know, he has a very upbeat sensibility about him.
Of the two late-night brands who will once again compete, Murray thinks Leno's brighter personality will once again beat out David Letterman's sarcasm.
Jay, a lot of times, stays more relevant when it comes to pop culture and contemporary topics, and he has a very non-threatening personality.
Jay Leno's image is like the friendly uncle who loves cars and a good clean joke. In the ads for his return to The Tonight Show, he's driving a snazzy sports car or high-fiving his fans.
Jay Leno's back in The Tonight Show, the Monday after the Olympics, here on NBC.
But lately, the nice guy has been accused of bullying Conan O'Brien out of The Tonight Show spot so he can take it back.
Will that have impact on his fans? It might.
Bill Carter is the author of the book and movie The Late Shift, about the late-night wars of the 1990s, when Leno and Letterman were fighting for Johnny Carson's chair.
There's a sense that he'll do well, but maybe not as well as he used to, at least initially. But Jay is indefatigable. One thing I know about him is he won't let up. He'll throw himself into this.
Already, Jay Leno has acknowledged his brand is tainted. That was during a heart-to-heart with Oprah Winfrey.
I think there's a lot of damage control that has to be done. You know, the only way you can fix these things is to try and do good shows, not be bitter, not be angry or upset.
Jay Leno might not show any bitterness moving forward, but he got some pretty good jokes out of being jerked around by NBC and by his biggest rival.
And Letterman. Letterman's been hammering me every
night. Weird.
Going after me. Hey, Kev, you know the best way to get Letterman to ignore you?
What's that?
Marry him. Okay, that's the best way.
The brand strategy for Jay Leno's new Tonight Show is anyone's guess. Bill Carter says since it wasn't broken before, they shouldn't try to fix it. Longtime band leader Kevin Eubanks is expected to leave the show to do more touring and recording. Leno's guests next week include Jamie Foxx, Sarah Palin, and the cast of Jersey Shore. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.